Well, very appropriate. Some of the things we did the last session, I had to hurry for an obvious reason. I've learned long ago that once you start smelling food or pizza, there's not much point in talking a little longer. And I realized that I rushed through the last four possibilities. Tomorrow morning, we're going to go into what I consider the strongest reason to understand why this battle has to occur between the rapture, which we just sang about coming again, and the start of the tribulation. In fact, this is a sort of coming attraction. I believe that what I will show you explains not only why that's when the battle has to be between rapture and the start of the tribulation, it's this battle that will actually trigger the movement with the Antichrist that will start the tribulation. So that's to kind of make you wonder or say, where's this guy coming from? Or, oh, yeah, he agrees with me. Isn't that good? So we'll look at that tomorrow. But I do try to repeat some things because I realize some things get kind of thrown at you, and then you suddenly, and I'm already moving on. And so we'll try to touch on a few things and see that you get that element. If and I always, you know, here's the commercial bit. We do have this as a booklet, and it covers the key points. So if you really want, and also you can hear the audio. So having all said that, if you're still, I hope, in Ezekiel 38, your stomach is satisfied with lots of pizza, and we do thank you. That was good. I do like pizza. Ezekiel 38, I'm going to read through the first 12 verses again, just so we keep the context. And I think we have a little more time now because we won't have food right afterwards. So, verse 1 of 38. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog in the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I'm against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And I will turn thee back, put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers, shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya with them, and all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his band, the house of Togarma of the north quarters and all his band, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared and prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee. Be thou a guard unto them. After many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. Thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, is gathered out of many peoples against the mountains of Israel, which have always been waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Thou shalt ascend, because you always ascend up to Jerusalem and much of Israel, and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shalt things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle goods that dwell in the midst of the land. So basically we've looked at Gog here. This is his plan because God has put it into his mind and combines with Gog's evil thoughts. This is what he's going to do. He's going to come up to Israel. The land is Israel. Gog, as I said last night, we believe is to be a Russian who is inspired by a demonic angel named Gog, the angel is, and this man is called by Ezekiel also Gog because of the influence of this evil angel. He will gather allies together, and he will come after Israel, and according to verse 12, he has come to take a spoil and to take a prey. So his goal is to come and get the spoil and take a prey. We have called Israel is the threatened land, and Gog is the threatening one. That's pretty much what we've covered in our two sessions. And I've told you that I believe this battle will occur after the rapture and will actually be, if you will, kind of an igniting force to bring about the events that start the tribulation. And tomorrow we'll explain that fully. So, today, Israel. We have just read that this is going to be, in verse 11, in a land come to pass, thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. Much has been made about these unwalled villages and dwelling in safety, and pointed out that Israel is not exactly safe today. So we're going to look at that. Today, with the exception of the ancient wall around Jerusalem, Israel is a nation without walls around its cities. One reason today is that walls offer poor protection against rockets and against missiles that come in across the land from Israel's enemies. Today, Israelis depend on other means of defending their homeland. They are confident in the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, and what is called the Iron Dome anti-missile system. And therefore, they do not fear a siege or attack by land as it would have been back in Ezekiel's day. So we have a hint that this is going to be in a different time when these events will take place, and it could fit today. After the church age believers are removed at the rapture, however, Gog is going to be lured into believing that the opportunity is ripe to come against the tiny nation to seek spoil and prey. See, today, and I just saw this in the news, so I'll pass it on, the Vatican has recognized the state of Palestine as a state. Now, that's a significant move. And one article I read, the person commenting in it said, basically, the election in Britain that just occurred could affect whether Britain remains an ally of Israel, but if Britain doesn't, the United States is the last one. And many of you have believed, as I do, that at the rapture, enough Christians will be removed from the United States. There will be no influence for the U.S. to defend it. So Israel will be alone at that point. So I've introduced this idea of spoil and prey as we read the verse. There are significant implications in the idea of coming down to get the spoil and the prey. Gog would like to do it. We need to understand it in greater depth to understand what would motivate Gog and his allies to attack Israel, and to see if those motives are viable today as possible things that would happen. And so this could be something that could happen in our lifetime. The term spoil and prey are actually uniquely phrased in the Hebrew. Don't you like that when people say, in the original, you need to know it? Well, you don't need to know it. You can have a computer. But it is important to watch the distinctions. Literally, the phrase is to take spoil, spoil, and to take a prey, prey. You see, any time a word is repeated in the Hebrew, it is to indicate the intensive use, not just the average, you know, spoil. It's spoil, spoil. Do you get that? It's intensive. This is what's driving them. Thus, the phrase actually literally means, in our type of language, to come and get great spoil and great prey. This isn't just to get a few $100. This is going to be a massive attack to gain the prey and the spoil. Now, I have studied extensively and looked very hard in commentaries and writings of Bible teachers. I've asked several Bible teachers to discover what's the difference between spoil and prey. God uses two different words. What is the difference? As I've looked at the commentaries, I've discovered that actually no one answers the question. If you look up the meaning of prey, it's spoil. If you look up the meaning of spoil, it's prey. Okay? So the question is, why did God use it twice? What is it telling to us? And I'm going to suggest a possible answer that is based, I believe, on the observations of Israel's foe that are specifically named in Ezekiel 38. As we've already learned, or not already, that was cut off in the last session, we learned the context that spoil means plunder, the old-fashioned term that pirates did. The plunder, it's what you obtain in war. It's the goods that you get as you conquer a land. That is your spoil. Some of the members of the Alliance of Gog, however, are going to attack for a purely material gain, while others are going to attack for a whole different reason, and that's where the word prey comes in. Prey has a slightly different aspect or motive. Spoil is goods, what you make money from. All right. But prey has a theological inference. It suggests that one's gain is gaining materially from an enemy in order to demonstrate their God's, with a little g, their God's blessing or curse upon the foe or the enemy. In other words, if I conquer because I want to show that my God is more powerful than my enemy's God, I will succeed and get much material gain that reflects that really my God is better. You see that? So we have these two different differences. The spoil indicates material gains from a successful invasion. Prey indicates an ideological or theological gain of victory over one God over another God, with the prey being the physical evidence of the superiority of the one's God. And these gods that I'm referring to are all little g's, so you understand. As we're going to shortly see, when we identify the nations involved in the battle, the prey element of Gog-Magog coalition indicates the Islamic nation's desire to dominate and demonstrate that Allah's superiority over the God of Israel through their success and the plundering of the nation of Israel and the destruction of the Jewish people. Some of the nations that will attack Israel at this battle are doing it purely and simply for economic gains, while others attack for this ideological and theological victory over Israel. Look at verse 13. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, this is to Gog, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away, notice what they're carrying away, silver, gold, to take away cattle, goods, to take great spoil. So in other words, these countries are business cities that are speaking here in terms of Sheba and Dedan. They're saying, what are you going to get? What are you going to gain from this financially? And then, so that Gog's army is coming down to Israel, obviously, for a gain. And God says that I will bring thee against my land. I'm getting ahead of myself just slightly in 16. Verse 16, thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days. I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. This verse is saying by God that God's purpose in doing this is to demonstrate that he, God of the Bible, that he, God of the Bible, is the one and only true God in the universe. And he is the only one who is worthy of worship, and by defeating Gog and Gog's allies, the world will recognize the power of the God of Israel. Thus, in defeat, the heathen nations that come against Israel, those armies will recognize that the true God has defeated their false God, Allah, in the land of God's chosen people. Gog and his coalition will actually become, if you will, the prey at the end of this thing instead of what they went for. Gog and his armies become the prey and not the people of Israel. As he did in the Old Testament days, God will openly defeat the enemies of Israel, and the world will recognize it. There's another reason why I believe the church has been removed before this Gog-Magog battle takes place, because God is focusing in on his nation Israel and his people, the Jewish people. There's no indication that this has anything to do with the church. So it's focusing on them, and he is openly defending what? Israel against the eyes, in the eyes of the world. So in other words, if you think of a spotlight, it's focusing purely on Israel. So the church being gone eliminates any confusion, any question of focus, etc. It's clearly a time for Israel. Now, let's consider the term spoil, how it could be connected with my hypothesis that Gog is Russia. What could be the possible motive for a former Soviet nation to attack Israel in our day? Let's see if this is feasible now, or if we really should push it way off into the far future. A very recent statement about Israel suggests the answer. And I'm quoting, this was in an article on Fox News. All right, this is a quote. Instead of being an embattled and isolated outpost of Western democracy, Israel looks like the Middle East's new economic colossus. What could possibly raise Israel to this economic colossus? The answer is very simple. Oil and natural gas. As you look, these are all offshore wells. Natural gas is very big in Israel. These are other sites. Now, there's another site that I have to kind of point out about here, which we kind of smile at. There is a company now drilling for oil there, natural gas, and things are looking up very good. And they asked Americans to invest in the company as a sign of support of Israel. So we have a tiny little oil well there. But oil is becoming big in Israel. It is now estimated that the land of Israel, and this is quoting, holds almost 250 billion barrels of oil shale reserves. Just to compare that, this compares with Saudi Arabia, which I think of as the oil country. Saudi Arabia has 260 billion barrels. That's 10 billion more than Israel. That's the only difference. Now, 10 billion is 10 billion, I know. But out of 200 billion. Fox News again said, thanks to the industrial technological miracle known as fracking, Israel is about to become the new energy mecca of the Middle East, and there's very little its Arab neighbors can do to stop it. Close quote. While many countries would be envious of this potential wealth, why would Russia be particularly eager, if you will, to get it? Well, today, 42% of the European Union's oil and 25% of its natural gas comes from Russia via the Ukrainian pipelines. That's why I showed you the pipelines last night, all right? Therefore, as Israel's capability increases, Russia's needed revenue from energy is going to decline because of what? Competition. Here's an interesting graph. I told you Russia was economically depressed in 1998. Here's where Putin has ruled and sort of ruled here. He really ruled there. And look at the growth of Russia's economic power. And that's all been due to oil, natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy. As the price of oil has declined, as the value of the dollar has gone up, Putin has to get more and more product and sell more product to keep his country moving ahead. His goal is to restore Russia to its former greatness. That costs money. Invading Israel and taking over its energy resources would strengthen Russia's monopoly as provider of the EU's energy needs. And again, a recent study, the EU is talking to Cyprus as a way to get oil from Israel, to bring it to Cyprus and then into the European Union, and to bypass other pipelines, Turkey, Russia, etc., because they're concerned that Russia will cut off the oil coming through the Ukraine. That's our world today. I believe God will use Israel's economic prosperity and resources to entice Gog to attack Israel and to bring about Gog and his coalition judgment. Now, if you look at verse 4, I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth all thine army. Notice the I is God, and he's bringing forth Gog and Gog's army like a fish with a hook on its chin. He says they will come as a great all thine army, horses and horsemen. So I've pictured horses and horsemen. I take the scriptures literally unless it doesn't make sense. So I believe we're going to see horses and cavalry again. Interesting. This enticement could well be part of the general stage setting in preparation for the battle of Ezekiel 38 and 39. As I've taught earlier, I believe this battle has got to take place prior to the start of the tribulation, but after the rapture. While the rapture can occur at any moment, verse 7 suggests an admonition for Gog and his allies. Look at verse 7. Be thou prepared. Prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. In this verse, God is expressing a form of taunt to Gog. You say, would he do that? Well, in the Hebrew, it's a taunt. Charles Feinberg, who's a noted Bible scholar, noted that this is the consummate and telling irony for God to tell Gog to be fully prepared for the encounter. It's folly to believe that one can battle against God Almighty and to win. For no one can be adequately prepared for such a battle. So it's a taunt. Be thou prepared, Gog, but he can't possibly win. This is not, this battle, going to be a minor skirmish or an isolated attack. God is indicating and telling Gog to prepare to his utmost for this battle. A major war is going to occur, and it requires a gathering of men and equipment for the battle, and its outcome will be a defining point in military history that the whole world will be watching. Furthermore, Gog, as leader of the amassed forces, is to, and the word says, guard unto them, to be a guard to them. That means he is to carefully watch over the array of the army coming together and to prepare them, and he's to supervise it himself. So you have the top level leader of a country is to supervise his armies in this coming preparation for the battle. In verse 4, we see an array of weapons that are going to be amassed. It's going to be horses, horsemen, terms that we're not as familiar with. We know what armor means. Great company with bucklers and shields and handling swords. Ezekiel's description often has been ridiculed and reinterpreted in order to make it seem feasible in our day, because people get embarrassed saying, swords? How are you going to fight swords today? You know, with the weapons of the world. Well, what army would use horses to fight today? Seems ridiculous. Well, I found it very interesting because I watched the news a lot. There's a recent series of news articles. There's a new form of horse has appeared in the military. Now, you may not recognize them immediately. It's a robotic cross between a goat and a pantomime horse, as the article describes it. It's designed to carry 400 pounds of payload and travel 20 miles without refueling. You see, the military packs that the soldiers have to carry today are reaching the limit. They can't handle it. So I'm told. I haven't had one lately. We have to check with your son, maybe. He can tell us. Recently, this horse has been tested in Hawaii. It's called the Legged Squad Support System, or LS3. It's being tested by the U.S. Marines and is foreseen as the future means of helping the foot soldier. Perhaps now, Ezekiel's horses are robotic horses, or perhaps there's a more literal possibility. I want to say this carefully here so nobody laughs at me. In May of this year, last year, a scene reminiscent of the 16th century Cossack funeral was enacted in Russia. And I'm quoting from it, "Cossacks in crimson coats carrying leather whips, sabers," that sounds like swords, "streamed after a riderless horse at a local chieftain's funeral in a Russian coastal city on the Black Sea." If you'll remember the map yesterday, where was the Ukraine and that part of Russia? It was on the Black Sea. This is in the Russian part down of the Black Sea. The Cossacks are descendants of the Scythians, who were famous for their horses. And the Cossacks were the troops that were feared most in previous wars. They are notoriously skillful horseback riding warriors of Russia, and they were disbanded in June 1st of 1918, but were reinstated in World War II when Hitler came into power. The reason was very simple. They needed the Cossack military might. There was a statement issued in 1941, and this is what they observed. "They have gotten back the uniform, the horse, the saber, and the dagger. They have been restored to a place of honor in Soviet society." At that time, the Cossacks were described as a rising tide in the military. Historically speaking, the Cossacks are renowned always for their strong Russian nationalism, that's loyalty to Mother Russia, and their zeal to support Mother Russia's expansionism under the rule of a czar. For Putin, the Cossacks are a kind of mascot that represents his desire for a return for a more conservative nationalistic ideology. And this is a quote, "Putin relies on officialdom, the church, and the security services to govern." True. "This fits well with Cossack patriotism, and he has done everything in his power to support the Cossacks to returning to their great status." You see, when they were disbanded, they were also disallowed to be soldiers because they were so dangerous. All right. It's no accident that Putin was photographed riding horse, bare-chested, on a Cossack horse in Siberia. It's believed that the Cossack horse was first domesticated on the Pontiac Caspian steppe, the land of the Scythians. During the 1930s, breeders from this part of the world developed an even sturdier strain of the famous, and I always struggle a little, Kurdzik horse, a breed that is best known, notice this, to be able to cope with almost any kind of terrain. You see, they can go anywhere, literally anywhere. Their performance was praised by one observer of the time as being the best means to travel, and this is an interesting comparison. This is a direct quote. "The terrain lying between the land of Gog and the land of Gog," of God. I told you I'd mix it up one of these days. Okay, say that again. "Between the land of Gog," and this writer was referring to Russia, "and the land of God, speaking of Israel," he said, "the terrain in between the two are best traveled by the Cossack horse." Interesting, isn't that? Understandably, you might challenge the literal interpretation of Ezekiel when it comes to horses being used in the battle of Gog Magog. In reply to this, I say simply, I'm going to quote Anatoly Kontsevoy, head of the Ryazan Paratroopers College of Russia. Okay, this is a military college training paratroopers. He says, it's very difficult to use heavy equipment when carrying out military activities in mountainous and forested areas. Thus, the use of horses is necessary for speed and mobility. Using the horse as an example of how Ezekiel's prophecy could be fulfilled literally now, I'm concluding that not only horses, but also weapons that could be burned for 7 years should be taken literally in Ezekiel 38. Our logic doesn't always apply. And I'm sorry I don't have that satellite picture again, but it would show you dramatically the Caucasus Mountains and the mountains of Afghanistan and all the other countries that are going to be involved. There's no way a tank's easily going to move over those countries, but a horse could. So it's not so preposterous, right? Having considered the army's preparation for this war, I'd like to consider the motivation of the countries whose armies are involved, first from the economic viewpoint, but then from the ideological, theological viewpoint. The economic viewpoint is going to help us to better understand why the second ideological participation will exist. So who is involved? That's the key. The names listed in Ezekiel, some of them are unfamiliar to you, and some of them are very familiar, but once we identify the locations of them, you're going to see how familiar they are to you right now. Ezekiel identifies Gog's allies in terms of the ancient Table of Nations found in Genesis 10. Obviously, boundaries have changed through the years. So what we're going to try to do is establish as close as you can today's countries and show where they fit in those ancient boundaries. When he wrote in the 6th century BC, Ezekiel's national boundaries were different than they are today. So in Ezekiel 38:2, where he says, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog," and then he mentions the chief prince of Meshech, Tubal, and prophesy against him. In the latter days, the prince of Meshech and Tubal will organize a military coalition. It will consist of 5 prime nations to attack Israel and to take spoil. I've already showed you that Gog, the chief or prince of the people of Meshech and Tubal, is either a human leader or a demonic angel influencing him. I said that it appears on everything in our studies that we have done, and even the most recent studies of the Middle East and the whole Persian area, etc., into Russia, that Gog would be a Russian leaving from Moscow. I'm not saying he's a Moscovite, but that's where his center of power would be. He will govern the land of Magog. Most scholars today and historians trace Magog's descendants to the ancient Scythians who lived in southern Russia and the nations between that are now part of the Russian Federation and nations between Turkey and Iran. In addition to Magog, Ezekiel lists the allies of Gog as Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer, and Togomar. I used to say, and I'm talking about 2 months ago, we know what Persia is, it's Iran. But I have been taking this course on Persia, and I have found out that the Persia of Ezekiel's day, as I've been telling you several times to get it across, goes all the way from Indus River in India, all the way coming west, up into Greece, through Turkey, up into the Ukraine, and very interesting, it touched Saudi Arabia, was part of a Saudi Arabia, it was Egypt and Libya, the Persian Empire, during its time. It was a massive empire. I have taken a map of all the countries that are under terrorist assault today in the Middle East, the ISIS country groups and some of the others, and with the exception of Yemen, they match exactly the territories of the ancient Persian Empire. And I have gotten, and anybody can get it, it's on the internet, a document of the man who founded ISIS and his goal. His goal is to reestablish the Persian Empire. Now, he is dead, so he's not going to do it. But that was the blueprint, was to do that. So I think when we think of Persia, I have shown it on the map here as Iran, but it also included Syria, included Iraq, much of Turkey over here, went down here, and now I have to go, you can see it went down here and actually goes down to here, and then over here, and just touched into Libya, but not fully into Libya. So Persia is a vast empire, and it's possible what we're seeing today is the reorganization of that empire. Studies have been made recently on Iran, ancient documents, and now they've confirmed that the empire was that size. And just a few years ago, they weren't totally sure. Okay. During an interview, a televised interview on February 5th of last year, the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, commented on Iran's international relations. He asserted that there is now a new dynamic, that's his word, new dynamic in Russian-Iranian relationships. And you may know that Russia is negotiating on nuclear plants for Iran. The common factors linking Russia and Iran today are geographical and energy related. It becomes very apparent when you look at their map and their strategies and their goals of how to supply the world's energy and get the money from it. Why do they have to have the sanctions cut in Iran? Because they got to sell their oil again. And they want to do it on the open market, not the black market. It's very easy to see how this alliance could form between Russia and Iran and be turned against Israel, which is becoming the economic oil and natural gas center of the Middle East. In addition, Islamic interest in the Caucasus countries within the Russian Federation, that's the old Scythian area, coincide with the Islamic Iranian leaders' ideological desire to destroy Israel. They want to destroy it just because it's Israel. While Russia's motivation for attacking Israel is spoil, Iran's is largely ideological or to take a prey. This is reflected in the Brigadier General Hossein Salami, senior commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, when he said, and I quote, "Today we can destroy every spot which is under the Zionist regime control with any volume of firepower that we want right from Iran." That's what their head of their guard is saying. He wants to destroy Israel. Okay, the next countries we read about are Ethiopia, also called Cush elsewhere in your Bible. This is not the Ethiopia of today. This is not the Ethiopia that you might think of as the African South Eastern African country. Rather, as a descendant of Ham and put founded a modern-day state, bear with me here, I jumped ahead of you. I'm already ahead of you, you see, in this case. I want to get back to Ethiopia is Sudan, the country of Sudan today, if you check the borders, the ancient borders. So here we have Sudan. Egypt, by the way, is not listed in any of these countries. Egypt's also a country that still has a peace treaty with Israel. So it could well be Egypt will continue to honor its treaty. All right, now I'm back on track here. Sudan lying south of Egypt. There was a raid last year by the Israeli Defense Force on the Red Sea that captured an Iranian ship, you may remember that was loaded with missiles, ammunition, and other arms. It was determined that those weapons were to be unloaded in Sudan and then smuggled through the Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula up to so Hamas in Gaza could use them against Israel. Hamas is a major enemy of Israel, and their senior official said the Hamas movement, I'm quoting, and Iran have special measures, and we will see many changes in our relations soon. They're trying to unite so that they can both come against Israel. Sudan is one of the strongest Islamic countries in its hatred of Israel. Now we're going to get, after that, we get to Libya. And you guess what country Libya is? It's Libya. Isn't that easy? That really is Libya. No confusion this time, all right? It's the nation just west, and you can just see it clipped there, of Egypt. Libya's past leader, some of you will remember, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He was a radical Islamic leader of a country with a long history of hatred for Israel. In fact, you can read books about events that occurred in Libya against Israelis. The history demonstrates that Libya has a strong desire to see Israel under attack. There is one problem with Libya today. It can't get organized. It is a very divided civil unrest in its country, is extensive, and at the moment has not pulled itself together. Once it could be ready. However, history repeats over and over that a country often can unite if somehow they can create a common foe. And it's possible they may find something they can use to make the Libyans unite together against Israel. The next coalition, there's our PUT or Libya, and there's Sudan. The next coalition is Gomer. This is a descendant of Noah's son Japheth, and we learn that he is from the area of Cappadocia, which is central and north central Turkey today. The nation of Turkey today is very much like the nation of the Ukraine. It shares borders with both Europe and the Middle East. And at different times, it's not sure whether it wants to be European or Middle Eastern. It is struggling. Whether it wants to be Islamic nation, following Sharia, or more European in its Islam. This nation is divided in its loyalties between these two regions. Like the Ukraine, the day is going to come where it's going to have to choose between them. Over the last several years, there have been a decided drift toward a stronger Islamic theology and ideology and Sharia law in Turkey. With it has been a growing movement away from supporting Israel. In the past, Turkey was a major supporter of Israel. Turkey has a history of connection to Israel prior to World War I. After that, they lost Israel, the Ottoman Empire. The Turks were very favorable to Israelis until very recently. The Turks have allowed our armed forces to use bases in Turkey to help Israel during some of the Israeli wars. That has all been diminished significantly, and Turkey is turning against Israel. It is possible, and I've taught this for a long time, or believed it's possible for a long time, Turkey could divide into a European part and a Middle Eastern part. That division could be reflected, we see here in the actual description, because we just can't say Gomer is Turkey. It's a part of Turkey. Okay. The final country is the House of Tugarma in verse 6. Ezekiel informs us that the House of Tugarma is a supplier of horses, horsemen, and mules in Ezekiel 27, verse 14. From Herodotus, which was an ancient historian, we learn that the House of Tugarma was famous for its horses and mules. Keep going back to horses, don't we? Many scholars believe that Tugarma is an ancient city of Tagarma, which is found in eastern Turkey. In the past, some people made these countries Germany, and you'll find that many of the writers personally did not like Germany. So it became handy. All right. Let history, let documents guide you, not emotions. Gog is going to plan what appears to be actually a masterful attack against Israel from multiple fronts. I had just enough military to learn that if you can surround your enemy, you've got a pretty good opportunity. And if you'll notice, you have a pincer action here coming down, over, up, and here. And you only have desert over here, so that's no problem. You have sea there. So it is actually very logical from a military standpoint for the Russian Federation members, Turks, Iranians, to the south, the armies of Sudan and Libya, to the west, the Mediterranean Sea protects, and the east is the desert. For Russia to attack Israel requires a solid land base to move its troops. That explains why Russia needs Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, because that's land to move its troops over, because the sea alone is not sufficient for the kind of warfare that would seem to be indicated here. It's key to note that while Magog's allies are all predominantly Islamic nations, none of them are Arab nations. That's very important to take a note of. You see, Arab nations are descendants of Abraham. So they're cousins of Israelis. God in the scriptures will deal differently with them than he will with these nations. These nations have no family ties back to Abraham. Therefore, they are Islamic. And just an aside, Putin is actually very anti-Islamic, but he is willing to use them. Okay. So God will lure these Islamic nations down to Israel with the purpose of judging them for their treatment of Israel. Jordan, an Arab neighbor, and Egypt, a non-Arab nation, is not going to join in this battle. Possibly because both of those today have treaties with Israel and continue to honor those treaties. And most people believe they will in the future. The Islamic faith is growing today throughout Russia, despite efforts of the government. Quote, a large number of Islamic religious clerics are winning Russian converts from atheism and other religions to Islam. Recognizing these Islamic trends, we can see how the forces could unite against God and his people, Israel. This is not, and I stress it, a family feud. That's what we have between the Arabs and Israel, a family feud of spiritual significance. This is a battle between the Islamic armies who believe in Allah, who is going to conquer the God of Israel and the Israelites and destroy them once and for all. The goal is either spoil, in the case of Russian, that's materialism, and in the case of the Allies, it's destroyed to show that Allah is the power over the God of Israel. And that's where we're going to end this tonight. Tomorrow we're going to show you more about the actual timing and why that timing is so significant to the tribulation and the start of the tribulation.